You're listening to the Food and Farming Podcast from AHDB. Practical know-how to help your farm business.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the AHDB Food and Farming Podcast. My name's Jason Hendy. I am the Knowledge Exchange Manager for the Southwest Cereals and Oilseeds. Speaking to you today from the AHDB stand here at Groundswell. Needless to say, regenerative agriculture, it's the theme. An ever-increasing level of interest, both at our own monitor farm meetings, our strategic farms, and then also just looking at the sheer growth of this show from quite a small beginning up to what's now widely termed a festival. So, you know, clear increasing traction and interest in this differing approach to agricultural production, I suppose we might say. The basic thrust obviously being trying to strike this balance between maximised output to feed a growing population, but also increasing awareness of environmental footprint and, you know, wider socio-economic factors. The sort of old-fashioned sustainability triangle, trefoil, if you like. So in this episode, we're going to bring you some insightful discussion from a range of speakers, basically trying to knit together this wider system. And we've just finished our first panel session in a all-to-the-rafters marquee, standing room only, lots of discussion and lots of question and answer that followed. So yes, welcome and please enjoy. So now I hand you over to John Palsey, who chaired the first session entitled Mind the Gap, essentially looking at break crops in arable rotations, a perennial point of discussion, trying to balance returns against an entry into a first wheat, the driving force of most rotations. Always lots of opinion, always lots of variables, and a very worthwhile discussion to be had.
So my name's John Palsey and I've just chaired the session Mind the Gap, which is actually looking to search for the ultimate alternative break crop. And I've interviewed Alice Andrews, who's from Ceres Rural, and she puts herself up as an enlightened agronomist, and I've worked with Alice before and she certainly is that. And then we've got Jonathan Hodgson, who farms at Great Newson Farm, and he's grown a huge amount of different break crops. And so we heard some real nuggets of useful information from Jonathan. And then lastly, we've had James Standen, who is Farms Director at Newcastle University Farms, and he's also a farmer himself, and he's also engaged hugely in a lot of break crops on the farm. So we had some really great chats, and at that point I'm going to hand you over to the speakers.
So my name's Alice Andrews, I work for Ceres Rural, and I'm an agronomist and farmer consultant in the east of England, covering Essex, Cambridgeshire, Hertfordshire. I was here today on the panel to discuss the panacea of break crops in the UK and what makes them profitable and which ones to choose. My top tips for growing a break crop are, first of all, choose something that you're interested in and passionate about. So that will give you the confidence and the motivation to persevere in years that sometimes can be a bit tricky. Make sure you have the right infrastructure and kit on farm. So do you need to hire in swathers, special harvesting equipment? So make sure you're geared up for the crop that you choose. If you can, have a contract that will help you with your budgeting, but it'll also help you get rid of the crop at the end of the year. So you don't want to be taking up stores with small tonnages of crops. And also look at how that crop fits in with your whole rotation. So is it going to impact your entry to first wheat? Is it going to be late harvest? Is it going to leave your soil in less condition? So making sure that it bolsters your wheat crop and your cash crop isn't actually to the detriment of that crop.
Hi, Jonathan Hodgson, farmer from East Yorkshire. I've been in the HDB tent today talking about growing flax. We've grown flax for 2 years now. It's been a bit of a challenge because it's growing an alternative crop we've not grown. Well, we've grown linseed, but flax is slightly different. So growing flax is a whole host of trying to understand the agronomics of it, what might eat it, how it established in the springtime after a cover crop, after I've been grazing animals on it. So it's taken us 2 years to really understand how to best treat the crop and get it established. But then you've always got the challenge of the weather to get over as well. But we think this year we've done a really good job. We've got a good established crop that hopefully will yield enough to generate a good margin. A top tip, I think, is just finding an outlet of a particular break crop that you've got a definite outlet for it. You don't want to be lumbered with something that you cannot sell. That doesn't benefit anyone. Give it a go on an area of land that you feel comfortable with.
My name is James Standen. I'm the Farms Director for Newcastle University, 800-hectare mixed farming operation in Northumberland, and I also farm in partnership with my wife on 300 acres in North Yorkshire. So at Newcastle, yes, we are conducting trials and research, and we host open days and other things for it, but getting an inside track on that certainly helps with what we do at home. We've done a little bit of work up at Newcastle on living mulches, which I've taken back home and using. But I've also done a little bit at home in setting up living mulches that we're now implementing at Newcastle. So it's a mixture of the two, both ways, as most farmers would hopefully get talking to each other and looking at what research and trials are done. Has it built anything into longer term, into the rotation plan? It's probably a bit of a challenge at the university because I don't know what new project's coming up. But we factor in the things that we like doing. Protein, whole crop silage for the cows we like, so we've carried that on. But what comes out of the lupin work, for example, I don't know yet because we're only at the start of the trial. What we've seen work really well at home is the lay phase, or the lay phase of our rotation, and establishing the living mulches. When we set those up, the first couple of times we set those up into arable fields and we put the livestock in, the insect life followed. And we really like that, and now we're seeing beetles walking across, we're seeing a lot of insect activity, and if we're going to try and hit the sustainable farming incentive targets around less insecticide use and IPM, that management, that using that break crop, you know, the grass, and setting up for the next one is going to be a key part of our arable business moving forward.
So we've had some just fantastic reaction from the audience. And actually, fun enough, even though we learned a lot from our speakers, we also learned a huge amount from the questions and also the kind of things people were saying in the audience. But right at the end, I asked our speakers for some top giveaway tips so somebody could go away from the stand and really change something in their farms. And actually, it was really simple. They just said, just go and give it a go. And I think actually it's about having the confidence to do that. And I think hopefully everyone listening to the session would have really felt that. I certainly did.
Okay, so super discussion had there regarding minding the gap and some really good input, including some slightly niche break crop options. So that brings that session to a close. Now we move on to session two, with the basic question being, is perennial agriculture the future? Where we're going to hear a range of approaches to perennial agriculture, from basic perennial grass, sort of mixed farming systems, through to agroforestry and perennial wheat, etc., at the more radical end of the spectrum. Over to our chair, Stephen, to get on with session two.
I'm Stephen Briggs, and this session's been about perennial agriculture and is it the future? And we had three really interesting panellists: David Miller from Hampshire, farming 700 hectares of regen; Dominic Amos from Oxfordshire, who's a crops researcher by background and an agronomist working with annual grains and perennial grains; and Emily from Perth, working with perennial grassland systems and sheep. During the session, we heard from both the audience and also from the panelists about different perennial systems and how clovers and legumes and integration of livestock can transform farming systems and build resilience and improve soil health. We heard about some of the opportunities with agroforestry and how farming in a three-dimensional way using woody perennials can bring resilience into systems and help manage water and evapotranspiration, build productivity and resilience into systems. We heard about some of the opportunities from perennial grains, perhaps plants that we haven't explored to date, which might feed livestock but also produce seeds and could produce alternative food crops. We discussed things like kernza, perennial grain bred by the Land Institute in Kansas in the USA, and some of the legislative challenges of bringing those things from other parts of the world and making them applicable or usable in the UK. We talked a little bit about, actually, this isn't only livestock or grain production, but actually how do perennials fit into horticulture. And now there's an opportunity to hear from the three panelists, Dave Miller, Emily and Dominic, to share their own experiences of where perennial agriculture fits within their own farming systems.
Hi, my name is David Miller. I manage a farm down in Hampshire where we are a strategic farmer for the HDB, and I've just done a panel session talking about perennial crops. It was a very interesting discussion about what are the barriers to perennial crops, and also lots of different ideas about what perennial crops are, which can be grass and clovers for livestock, or whether from a more arable perspective, looking at perennial wheats or living mulches. For me, the barriers really are research, and also the fact that we're trying an awful lot of things in a regenerative way anyway, that actually we need to get a lot of other things right before we move on to the next stage of perennial crops. I think they will feature maybe 10 years' time, I think, once research is caught up with where varieties of perennial wheat are, and also understanding how living mulches can become more reliable than they are at the moment.
My name's Dominic Amos. I work for an organic grain merchant, Organic Arable. Prior to that, I was a crops researcher working with organic arable farmers, researching organic arable varieties and also looking at the incorporation of perennial crops like legume living mulches into arable systems. So I was speaking about the benefits of introducing perennials, the ecosystem services that we can gain from that, and some of the ecosystem disservices that we get from annual grain cropping systems. Really, the main thing that perennial crops can offer is to help build carbon, build soil organic matter, and regenerate soil. The best way to do it, actually, they put a lot of their resources and energy into root production, and that's a very good way to build soil organic matter. And obviously they don't require tillage, which is another way to protect and enhance soil quality. The barriers to perennial cropping systems, well, actually, there are already perennial cropping systems in part. We have agroforestry, and that's gaining popularity and prevalence now. Organic farmers and some non-organic farmers have lays in the system, so they're growing perennial crops, clovers, grasses, that they have for 2 years to help build soil fertility. So actually, maybe the barriers aren't as great. Obviously, grass is perennial. So if we're trying to mimic those kind of natural ecosystems that are based on perennial polycultures, I think it's maybe that complexity, that lack of knowledge, and where farmers are trying to innovate, it's up to the industry to try to catch up and support them.
My name is Emily Grant. I am a sheep farmer and an independent consultant from Perthshire. And yeah, delighted to be here at Groundswell today and have been involved in AHDB seminar talking about perennial cropping in arable systems. Being a sheep farmer, I'm already running a perennial system, even though occasionally do use annual crops within that. We can obviously see benefits of having perennial systems, i.e. we're not quite so reliant on tillage. We also probably have reasonably good soil health in places as well. So it's great to be able to see and to share with people just what benefits that can bring. But I suppose I think as well for me is just how perennial systems can fit in, and particularly livestock systems can fit in arable annual systems, and the benefits that livestock can bring. Certainly I work with some farmers on herbal lays, which offer a really good perennial part into arable systems, and I see with clients as well, I think there would be great opportunities to work with arable farmers who are annual cropping to be able to integrate livestock into those systems, which will benefit both parties.
Okay, so thank you to all the contributors there. Some really interesting discussion had. I think all of us are very aware of the basic perennial lays and mixed farming systems, but it was really interesting to hear people making perhaps the more niche side of things, such as combinable crops in agroforestry and concurrent fruit production work. So really good to hear an actual tangible example of that over here in the UK. Day two at Groundswell in the AHDB Marquee, session three, discussing the genetic diversity of grains. Got another knowledgeable panel here, lots of questions and lots of interest regarding populations, heritability of traits and stability of those populations, and that's certainly a big theme. Now I'll pass you over to our chair for this session, who is Michael Marriage from Dove's Farm.
My name is Michael Marriage from Dove's Farm Foods. We've just had a very interesting discussion on the genetic diversity of cereal cropping in the UK. We had three very good speakers, Phil Howell from NIAB, Edward Dickin from Harper Adams, and Fred Price, an ecological farmer from Somerset. They each gave a presentation about the diversity of cereals and the breeding of cereals. And then there was a discussion about breeding, about saving seed and the problems with disease, population, wheats, mixed cropping are very lively, and there's a lot of experts here to make it a good and interesting discussion. And now I'll hand you over to our first speaker.
So my name is Phil Howell. I work for the crop science organisation NIAB, and I've just been speaking in the HDB meeting about diversity in the cereals. I spoke a little bit about some of what we call pre-breeding work. At NIAB, we've been exploring some of the genetic diversity of the wild relatives of wheat and bringing that in to broaden the gene pool that's available to modern breeders. So we work closely with commercial breeders on research projects, and we're looking at just capturing more diversity and then working out, is that good, is that bad, is that neutral, and hopefully making an impact on their breeding programs. And then another aspect of work I touched on, NIAB were asked by DEFRA to carry out a review of underutilised crops. So I spoke about some of the alternative crops to wheat, barley, oats that we could be growing to diversify our farms and our food systems. One point which might be worth exploring is, why do you need to increase the genetic diversity in the first place? So modern wheat has come through this enormous kind of funnel. So if you go back 10,000 years ago when the new species was first formed, there was lots of diversity in the relatives. In domesticating that into a crop, we've lost a lot of that diversity. And then in the years of selective breeding since then, especially under intensive situations, again, we've narrowed the availability that's there. So what we're trying to do is go back and explore the left behind diversity from these other sources and bring those in to try and make our crops more resilient.
I'm Edward Dickin, a lecturer from Harper Adams University. And what I've been talking about at Groundswell today is some of my work on naked barley, which is barley for human food, and some of the other diverse grains that I've been working on, things like landrace wheat crossed with the modern wheat varieties and then taking them forward as populations. Yeah, so the HDBs, I was looking at starting off from the base that a really undiverse system would be growing the same crop in all the same fields year after year. You can bring in diversity in three forms. You can have temporal diversity, as in a rotation. You can have spatial diversity, different crops in different fields or different crops in the same field, like intercropping. Or you can have genetic diversity. So that's the genetic diversity of the gene pool that's in it. Also different varieties or mixing varieties together or populations. And for the maximum effect, you really want to be doing all three. And where the naked barley work works in with that is that it covers all three, because it gives you another rotational option. You can have spatial diversity, which we're looking at with intercropping naked barley and peas, and a lot more genetic diversity, because we can use exotic varieties like from Tibet that are outside the malting barley gene pool and use those in crosses with British varieties and produce a lot more, a wider genetic base for the barley itself.
I'm Fred, and I'm a farmer in Bridgewater, Somerset, at Gothenay Farm. Both sessions, really, I was advocating for crop diversity, specifically cereals, and showing my experiences with growing population wheat. And in general terms, half of those experiences are about the agronomic side of it on farm, in a chemical-free system, and the other half are to do with rehumanising our supply chains and creating a kind of decommoditised grain system. And I think they have a role in both those areas. So, I mean, I talked today a lot about YQ wheat, which is a population wheat. Population is effectively a diverse wheat. Yeah. YQ has 20 parents selected for yield and quality. They're all crossed together, which is 190 different crosses. And when you cross a wheat, you can get around 2,000 or 3,000 different genotypes from each cross. So it's almost infinitely diverse, you know, 500,000 different genotypes in the same field, compared with, say, a brilliant wheat off the recommended list, KWX Stace, as is demonstrated by the fact that it has 15% of the market, 250,000 hectares. And what that means on farm is that you have a kind of evolutionary potential of the wheat, right? So breeders describe it as mass selection. It basically means they adapt and evolve and adjust to your situation, which as a farmer is awesome. Whereas KWS is only going to get worse, YQ is going to maybe not get better, but it's very resilient.
So that's the conclusion of session three, and now we move on to our fourth and final session on day two, which is getting comfortable with composting. So I'll hand you over to the chair for our final session, which is Julia Cooper from the Organic Research Centre.
My name's Julia Cooper, and I'm head of research at the Organic Research Centre. And I've been chairing a session here at AHDB in the tent about getting comfortable with composting. We had three speakers. Ben Taylor-Davis talked about Johnson Sue composting, which is a method that involves sort of a composting some waste in a container and really seems to be about promoting or producing a very microbially rich product to dilute and spread on the land to promote good bacterial and fungal populations in the soil. So he was kind of trying to sell that as a good way to manage some his organic waste. Then we had Andrew Sincock talking about Bokashi. So Bokashi is an anaerobic method of composting waste where you add some various additional products, some clay and some carbonaceous material and also some inoculant in the barn before you compost the material, and then it's basically fermented anaerobically, a bit like the silage process really, and the final product is then very, again, microbially rich and also well broken down and ready to spread in the fields. And then the third fellow was Billy Lewis, and Billy was more of a traditional farmer who composts his farmyard manure on farm by turning it in windrows, which is quite a kind of traditional way of making a compost. The idea being there that you enhance the breakdown of the material by getting lots of oxygen into that material. It gets quite hot, thermophilic, hopefully destroys some weed seeds and pathogens. Also, big reduction in volume with that method. And then you have a nice sort of more uniform material to spread on your land. So those were the three different approaches to composting we discussed in the session. So I'll hand you over to the first speaker to give you a bit more detail.
So my name is Ben Taylor-Davis, and today I've been on the HDB stand here at Groundswell talking about compost and the importance or the differences in the amount of compost that are available and trying to actually explain the differences between them and why they're either important or not so important. So the Johnson Sue method was actually developed by Dr. David Johnson from the University of New Mexico in the US, who, born out of frustration really of trying to make these biological composts that needed turning every single day or very specific water requirements and that sort of thing, and he basically came up with the idea of how do we change a system that can produce us a pretty much consistent result year on year or that sort of thing without all the hassle of trying to get it right. And more often than not, unfortunately, the compost turning goes more wrong than right. You end up with an organic amendment, you just don't end up with the biology. And basically the Johnson Sue is using what we call indigenous microorganisms. So you use the materials off your own farm, your straws and your muck waste and some fresh material, whether that be chip trees or grass cuttings or herbal lays or hedge cuttings, could be anything. And a little bit of a balance between all the green things, fresh, and when I say fresh, very fresh, and some of your brown things, and then a bit of nitrogen from any manures, whether that be horse, cattle, sheep, goats, whoever. Mix them all together, and then we essentially put them in generally in an IBC. We take the IBC plastic container away, cover the outside with some chicken mesh, and then fill it up. And while we're filling up, we put tubes up it. So essentially what happens is air can get down within the compost, and that's really quite essential. And then, interesting enough, after 2 or 3 days, you can remove the tubes, and the soil is formed around the tubes. And that's really quite important, so the air can then enter the whole of the compost and aerate it. And it takes a long time. It's got to sit there for nearly 400 days. And the only thing we do is put a bit of a coil of a hosepipe on top, on a timer. It does about a minute a day in the summer. Often in the winter, we turn it off altogether. Very simple method. You literally pick some compost up, squeeze it in your fist. If you can just see a droplet of water, that is the perfect moisture for it. So very, very simple. You wait these 400 days, and after that, I hasten to add, we add earthworms or composting worms after about 2 weeks. And then after these 400 days, you have this wonderful biological compost. We've made literally thousands of them and never seen one that actually came out as a non-biologically complete compost. So it is fantastic. So the three main benefits of Johnson Sue I see is, number one, cost. They are so low cost and they take nothing to build. And that's one of the things that is often put off. With the other forms of compost, you either need a turning machine or turning vessel of some description, or you need to invest in effective microbes and plastic and all those sort of things that come with Bokashi. So cost is something that is tiny in a Johnson Sue. The second one is this guaranteed biological inoculum. It's something we need to emphasise more and more and more, that in actual fact, this is something that you're adding to your soil to kickstart the whole biological process of the soil. And it's something we should be chasing at all stages. The third thing about Johnson Sue is the fact that you don't need a big area and you don't need a huge amount of material. The problem with the other two composts, it relies on a huge amount of waste from generally animals. Well, what happens if you have no animals? There's plenty of farms without them. This is something you can use literally with materials on your farm and able to create a compost and do all the good things you need to.
So my name's Andrew Sincock, and I am the director and joint owner of Agriton and AgriVital, a collection of companies that manufacture, source and supply a range of environmentally friendly agricultural inputs. Today with AHDB, I've been talking about bokashi composting. So bokashi compost being a form of fermentation as opposed to traditional aerobic decomposition. And that fermentation process is a way of retaining additional nutrients, not having the same losses into the atmosphere or pollutants into local watercourses, for example, but preserving those nutrients so we can put them back into the soil where they're actually needed. There's a number of different ways in which you can make bokashi. The most common, the easiest, the best, the most affordable would be to apply the microorganisms, so effective microorganisms, onto the bedding during the house period. So we're talking about animal bedding, so we could be talking about beef cows, dairy cows, lambing pens, even goat herds. It doesn't really matter. Anything that's being bedded with a carbon source, so that could be wood chips, sawdust, or even straw. Applying those microbes onto the bedding during the housed period will start the fermentation process. The inclusion of those microbes at that time will also help reduce disease pressure, and it reduces odours within the shed. So the ammonia smell is quite a strong smell within the animal housing. The inclusion of those microbes will stop the ammonia smell and also stop those ammonia emissions as well. What you would then do is when you come to clean out that shed, so animals go out or you want to clean them out, take that organic manure, take the bedding, put it into a heap somewhere in the corner of a field or in the corner of the yard. It doesn't need to be on concrete, could be on soil, doesn't really matter, and then in sile. So you're putting a last year's silage sheet on top of the bedding to ensure that it remains anaerobic. So the top three benefits to adopting bokashi on farm. First one would definitely be the retention of nutrients. So the fermentation process will retain almost all of the nutrients. What we've seen and when we've analysed it and we've had it tested, you lose about 3% of the total mass of a bokashi heap. So very minimal losses. The second benefit would be with those retained nutrients, we're reducing our losses. Losses on farm equate to emissions and pollution. And the third benefit, and most farmers would argue this would be their best and their most valued reason for making it, would be the management of and the spreadability of the bokashi that they're producing.
I'm Billy Lewis. I farm in Herefordshire. We are a mixed farm, so we've got cattle, sheep and arable. I've come to Groundswell to talk about how we turn our cattle manure into compost. I take a very unscientific approach. I don't really have time to get into the integrated detail about it. I use an aerobic method, which involves moving the cattle muck around a few times over the space of about 2 months. The benefit of the way I compost our manure, we end up with about half the volume of material to spread at the end, which is obviously a huge saving when it comes to spreading costs. We end up with a material that is a lot finer and a lot more consistent, which allows us to spread to 24 metres, meaning we can travel in standing crops in the spring and deliver the product to the crops when they're growing and they need it.
Okay, so that brings us to a close of session four, an impassioned debate regarding getting comfortable with composting. Despite the strength of opinion, it was largely a comfortable discussion. Lots of great interaction with the audience as well. And I think we all arrived at a viewpoint that essentially with composting, we need to have flexibility and an appropriate choice for our system, scale, etc., etc. But a fantastic close to what's been the last of four really good sessions. So to summarise, 2 full days, the full marquee for all of the sessions. In order, we started with rotation, mind the gap, mainly focused upon, you could say, simple economics and the seemingly eternal chase of reliable break crops. We had some interesting discussion there with some more niche ideas such as hemp as one example. Moving into session 2 on day 1, probably looking at something a little more forward-thinking with perennial agriculture potentially being the future. Discussion regarding potential for perennial wheat, living mulch understories, but then also the more traditional but perennial elements of a mixed farm rotation. The first session of this morning, really looking at some specifics actually in terms of the genetic diversity of grains. obvious interaction there with the recommended list and how these varieties are judged by both you, the levy payers, and the wider industry. That feeds in well to the ongoing review that's underway. But lots of interesting discussion also regarding varietal blends, so not just thinking of single varieties in isolation, and also the breeding and sort of molecular markers and progress in that regard. And then this final session, a barnstorming one really, very impassioned speakers, but some good tangible discussion as well about the actual specifics of on-farm composting, the three quite distinct, but you may also say sort of linked approaches. As with many things, obviously there's relative merits with each one, but again, some fantastic interaction with the audience and just a really lively, upbeat finish to an excellent couple of days here at Groundswell. Thanks for listening. Further information available on the AHD website regarding all of these sessions, as alluded to, obvious links to the recommended list in terms of genetic diversity of grains, but also the recently updated RB209 regarding composts. There's just two examples, so do check that out if you wish to delve a little deeper.
If you have any comments about this podcast or have ideas for future episodes, please email foodandfarming@ahdb.org.uk.